ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Arts in 30, your weekly digest of arts and culture news from across the globe. I'm Sky Kirkham. The Riyadh Comedy Festival in Saudi Arabia continues this week, with criticism mounting within the industry at those that chose to attend. Meanwhile, as we reported last week, Saudi Arabia's public investment fund is one of the investors purchasing the game studio Electronic Arts. It's all part of the Vision 2030 strategy in Saudi Arabia, and today on the show we'll explore why that's led to such significant investments in the arts and whether the initial barrage of criticism will matter in the long run. And I'll take you to WREN, the Women's Recovery Network, a mental health ward in Melbourne, to meet Becky Orpen, the artist that the facility invited in to run a workshop with the residents and to create colourful murals for the walls. But first, the headlines with C. Benedict. C, welcome. Sean Combs, aka Diddy, has faced sentencing in his trial in the US.
Yeah, good morning, Sky. A quick reminder that Combs was found guilty on two counts of transportation to engage in prostitution, but he was acquitted on three most serious charges he was facing: one count of racketeering conspiracy and two counts of sex trafficking by force, fraud, or coercion. Prosecutors had asked for a sentence of 11 years. The defense had suggested immediate release. The final sentence was 4 years and 2 months in prison, with the judge, Arun Subramanian, saying that the lengthy sentence was needed for deterrence. Why did it happen so long? Because you had the power and the resources to keep it going, and because you weren't caught.
And C, we'll be looking at Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030 strategy soon, but what's been the response in the comedy world to the Riyadh Comedy Festival this week?
Well, Jessica Kirsten has apologised for performing and said that she will give her paycheck to charity. Kirsten said, "I hoped that this could help LGBTQ plus people in Saudi Arabia feel more seen and valued. To my knowledge, I am the first openly gay comic to talk about it on stage in Saudi Arabia. At the same time, I deeply regret participating under the auspices of the Saudi government." Bill Burr, who was one of the other performers, called it definitely one of the top three experiences I've ever had. David Cross, who acknowledged that he didn't receive an invitation, wrote, "I am disgusted and deeply disappointed in this whole gross thing, that people I admire with unarguable talent would condone this totalitarian fiefdom for, what, a fourth house, a boat, more sneakers? We can never again take seriously anything these comedians complain about." And Dave Chappelle, probably the highest profile comedian performing, quipped on stage that it's easier to talk here than it is in America.
And I suppose that's true, depending on who you are and what you actually want to say. See what else is making news.
Jane Fonda is amongst the celebrities reviving the Committee for the First Amendment. Her father, Henry Fonda, was a member of the original group, which was created during the McCarthy era in the US. More than 800 entertainment figures, including Spike Lee, Billie Eilish, and Pedro Pascal, signed a statement saying, "The federal government is once again engaged in a coordinated campaign to silence critics in the government, the media, the judiciary, academia, and the entertainment industry." And in music, we reported a few weeks ago that Massive Attack had said that they wanted their music removed from Spotify because of the company's founder, Daniel Ek, investing 600 million euros in the military AI company Helsing. It turns out that the control of their music actually lies with the label, who have not removed their songs at this point. In fact, according to the Nine newspapers, streaming of the band on that platform has actually increased since the demand was made. And Paris Fashion Week is underway. One of the tentpole events in the fashion calendar, it sees over 15 designer debuts, with Mathieu Blazy, newly at the helm of Chanel, the hottest ticket. And Dame Jilly Cooper has died at the age of 88. The author of books like Rivals and The Man Who Made Husbands Jealous, Cooper was described by the BBC as the queen of the British bonkbuster. Cooper herself described receiving a damehood from the king last year as orgasmic, saying that, "I think it's incredible, magical for me. I was thrilled to bits. Writers work so hard. We do work hard. Books are terribly important. They cheer people up."
They do indeed. Valet Dame Jilly Cooper. C, thank you.
Thanks, Guy.
You're You're listening to Arts in 30 on Radio National. I'm Sky Kirkham. The Riyadh Comedy Festival continues this week, and while comedians like Louis C.K. and Bill Burr have defended their decisions to perform, many of their colleagues and fans have been forthright in their critiques. Also, over the last fortnight, the Saudi Public Investment Fund has made a major investment in Electronic Arts as one of the central groups involved in a bid to take over one of the biggest games companies in the world. Why is Saudi Arabia making such significant investments in arts and cultural events? Well, it's all part of the Vision 2030 strategy that was launched in 2016, led by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Given that, does the initial international response matter, or is the Saudi regime playing a longer game? Andrew Lieber is an assistant professor of political science at Tulane University and a non-resident scholar in the Carnegie Middle East program. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew, can we begin with a quick explanation of the Saudi Vision 2030 program? What is it, and why has it involved such a significant investment in the arts?
Sure. So Vision 2030 in literal terms was a white paper in 2016 that then Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman advanced as a strategy to reduce Saudi Arabia's reliance on oil, diversify its sources of income, and generally improve the efficiency of the state apparatus in the country. Since then, as Mohammed bin Salman has risen to power as the de facto ruler of the country, it's become kind of a shorthand for a wide-ranging program of policy changes in the country. Most relevant to the cultural sphere is Mohammed bin Salman's efforts to reduce the Saudi monarchy's reliance on religion and especially religious authorities as a source of legitimacy and legitimation. In terms of entertainment domestically, that's meant removing a lot of social restrictions that used to constrain things like public concerts or even movie theaters to both kind of offer entertainment as kind of a distraction from citizens, particularly as their own material standards of living might decline, but also to build a new economic sector inside the country, encouraging Saudis to spend a lot of money at home rather than venturing abroad to Europe or elsewhere in the Arab world for, you know, even basic entertainment like going to a movie theater or a bowling alley.
Yeah, because this comedy festival is the latest project that's been part of this, but there have been raves, there are art exhibitions. This has been a major series of events over the last 5 years, hasn't it?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's almost hard to pin down kind of exactly what's going on any given day in terms of Vision 2030. There are a range of other what are now called giga projects, major infrastructural investments. People might have heard, for example, of the planned city or urban area of Neom in the country's northwest. There are other major infrastructural projects in and around the city of Riyadh. And of course, there have been a number of major events associated with the country's new general entertainment authority, such as the raves you refer to, the kind of, EDM festivals in the desert surrounding Riyadh as part of an initiative called the kind of Middle Beast concert series.
Now, the Riyadh Comedy Festival has received a lot more pushback than all of the other art events that I've seen to date. There's been some pushback on the sports side of things, but I feel like in the visual art space, there hasn't been a lot. Glenn Lowry, for example, the outgoing director of the Museum of Modern Art in New York, has just announced that he'll work as an advisor at the Islamic Arts Biennial in Saudi Arabia. Why do you think this has gotten the attention it has? And I guess, more importantly, does that matter from a Saudi perspective?
Yeah, certainly. I think, I'm not an expert on the comedy scene, but I think certainly one factor is that you have people pointing out the perceived hypocrisy of a lot of individuals who kind of made their reputation on being edgy individuals who push the boundaries of accepted kind of commentary or statements you can make in a place like the United States, who've complained about perceptions that they feel their routines are being constrained by, I don't know, censoriousness in the United States. So now going and performing in a place like Saudi Arabia, where there are quite well-known and clear restrictions on what individuals can say in public. I think it's also that, you know, a lot of, you know, comedians like to talk, and so you've had a lot of them discussing what they plan to do or not do while they're in Riyadh in a number of various podcasts and other media forms in the run-up to this event. And I think a lot of their fans have taken this poorly in a way that kind of maybe, I don't know, finer arts patrons or enjoyers might not either be aware of or might not be as critical of when it comes to something like some of the other examples you mentioned.
Does that then matter for Saudi Arabia? Do they care that there has been the pushback at an international level to the event they're putting on?
Yeah, I certainly think it matters. There's clearly some sensitivity to the fact that, you know, even 7 years on from the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi by Saudi agents in Istanbul, that's still a topic of conversation whenever the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is mentioned in the media. You saw several comics who were invited to the Riyadh Comedy Festival, effectively uninvited after they mentioned various human rights abuses inside the kingdom, even though they mentioned these human rights abuses, examples of things they didn't care about in accepting a paycheck from the comedy festival.
One of the major allegations around these events is that they're art washing. They're using art to launder Saudi Arabia's reputation. Given this has sort of, you know, re-emerged, the allegations around Khashoggi, the ongoing human rights abuses, does it actually work to use something like this as a art washing event? It seems that it has us talking about those allegations once again.
Certainly. I'm not sure. I'm never really sure in terms of these events whether part of the aim is to necessarily improve Saudi Arabia's image with each and all of these events. Clearly, something like this comedy festival, perhaps part of the thinking might have been, oh, these individuals will go speak on their platforms about how great Saudi Arabia was. You know, we've seen it, maybe a couple of comedians do that, but that really hasn't been a dynamic from a lot of these comedians. Many of them have gone out of their way to kind of hide the fact that they're even performing in Saudi Arabia from their schedules that they've posted to social media. And I think it points to the fact that, you know, there is a demand inside Saudi Arabia for bringing in some of these international acts, whether it's because of domestic demand or people like the head of the General Entertainment Authority, Turki Al-Sheikh, demonstrating to his political superiors he can bring in these big acts. It nevertheless exposes the country to criticism. And then, you know, in some areas, there might not be as much criticism. You know, if they're bringing in, I don't know, a Philharmonic Orchestra or a fine arts director, maybe there won't be as much pushback anymore, but there will always be new areas where there will be kind of this unexpected degree of pushback, and they're going to have to kind of confront that and deal with that as they push this agenda forward.
Mm. One of the things it seems a lot of the coverage isn't talking about, though, is that there is an internal audience for this, as well as the whatever intention there is for an international perspective. This is at least in part, probably in large part, for an internal Saudi audience, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, it can be easy to forget the extent to which there is a pretty sizable audience inside Saudi Arabia for a lot of English language media, whether that's in the original language or in translation. Many Saudis have followed on satellite television or over the internet various Western comics or other Western entertainment outlets for years. I mean, for example, Gabriel Iglesias, who's one of the participants in the Riyadh Comedy Festival, already had a routine like over a decade ago in which he talked about how a Saudi prince had invited him to come give a private show inside the kingdom. And years before the Riyadh Comedy Festival ever got off the ground, there had been Saudi comics who had engaged in their own form of stand-up routines, whether that was posted to YouTube or in underground comedy clubs. And some of those own domestic talents are beginning to become like quite prominent to the extent that even there's a like a Saudi media and podcast company, Thamania, that I learned has just acquired a comedy club inside Saudi Arabia with the hope of producing a lot more sort of Saudi-based content directed at Saudi audiences in Arabic.
Mm, interesting. Andrew, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Andrew Lieber there, an assistant professor of political science at Tulane University and a non-resident scholar in the Carnegie Middle East program. You're listening to Arts in 30 on Radio National, your weekly digest of arts and culture news from across the globe. I'm Sky Kirkham. WREN, or the Women's Recovery Network, is a mental health ward in Melbourne. It was built after the Royal Commission into Victoria's mental health system. It's a women-only service that was designed in consultation with people who've had experience with the mental health system. It's a new fit-out in a multi-story building, more a fancy corporate office vibe than a health institution, but it needed a splash of colour and a bit of humanity. So as part of their strategy, Wren brought in the artist Becky Orpin to run a two-day workshop with the residents and create a series of murals that now decorate the walls of the facility. What effect does art have on the site and on the residents there? It's Mental Health Day this week, so I wanted to head out to Wren to meet Becky Orpin and Maria Bradshaw, who's part of the lived experience workforce there. And I began by asking Becky what goes into designing with and for a mental health space.
I guess first you look at the practicalities, like what is the space? Is it indoors? Is it outdoors? Because it's a new facility, there was quite specific colours that were used. So what are those colours? Where do we start with that? You know, it has a very quite, I guess, a calm tone. So we're looking at themes, you know, it's based around women's safety and mental health. And so we're looking at themes around that as well. So I guess I started, that was my first kind of headspace, is looking at the colours, looking at, you know, what the space was and how can, what themes we could use to sort of, I guess, encourage, you know, all those things in the space.
And one of the things that was part of this project was a workshop over several days with the participants at Wren. What did that involve and how did that begin to shape what we see on the walls now?
So it was actually quite involved, the workshop, not the actual workshop, which of course was really fun and great to work with the people here. But it was, I guess, deciding the themes of the workshop was quite a process. So initially, I think Wren came up with the theme. We came up with the theme together, which was Garden of Recovery. So I sent quite a few ideas based on the theme. We ended up something that was, you know, creating flowers from paper. I use a lot of paper in my work. I think the results of paper sort of translate really well to a painted mural form, quite flat, quite graphic. Paper is widely available for everybody. You can buy it from anywhere, which is one of the reasons I love to use it. And, you know, also that thing that if the participants liked it, they could go and create their own artworks out of paper. It's not out of, you know, it's really easy. So we got the theme, we got, you know, the task, I guess. And then I spent 2 days in here with, you know, the lovely people at Wren making. And it was, as I said, a drop-in, drop-out situation. So people could come and go as they liked. They could make as many or as little as they liked. They could just come and watch if they liked. It was a really great experience for me as well. I always feel selfish when I do collaborative artworks because I get so much out of it rather than just me working in my studio. Like, it's such a generous and lovely experience when you're actually in contact with people who are going to be involved in the work. I just think the result is so much nicer, especially in sort of communal spaces like this.
And from the perspective of the participants here at Wren, walking around the building, you see not just the murals on the wall, but there's a lot of art on the walls from people who are here or have been here before. What was the experience? What did you hear from the people who were participating in the workshops? And what were you hoping they got out of it? And what did you hear that they got out of it?
Yeah, look, a lot of the stuff that we do comes from feedback from our participants. We're always learning from them. And for some people, this is not their first experience of a hospital stay. And often they've done art elsewhere and they appreciate what art can bring to a space. We have art therapy groups here and we have one-on-one artist sessions. So there's quite a big art theme throughout anyway, and it's encouraged. And I think because we were seeing participants doing their own artwork, putting it on their doors, in their bedrooms, and in the communal spaces, we really connected with what they wanted from us. But we also recognized that the idea came from them and from their own artworks and just wanting that more. So to bring the participants into that process was really quite an inevitable thing for us to do. Having spoken to participants that were involved in the workshops, you know, there was quite a different, few different ways that they appreciate it. Just having an activity to do, you know, sometimes it can be quite boring here. Connecting with others, the fact that we had participants and staff in a shared space working on something together really kind of is a great leveler and a great way for us all to come together in a shared space on a shared task that's not mental health recovery focused. It's just about being together and doing art together. And that was great feedback. And then also just having someone external come in was really exciting for the people here. You know, sometimes people are here for an extended period of stay and they see the same faces. And other than their families coming to visit, there really isn't that opportunity for someone external to come and interact. And we got great feedback about just having someone external come in and still feel comfortable and safe in a space. And I think for me, that's why it worked so well, because Becky really understood the values and where we were coming from and what we were trying to get from the process.
And Becky, for you going through that workshop process, how much did that shape the end result of the work? I imagine you already had an idea of what you were going to do before you came into the workshops or even into the space. But did that shift over those several days you spent with the participants?
I would say definitely yes. I definitely think while I was here, I got a really good sense of what can be achieved here. And it was a really, I don't know, for want of a better word, it was really beautiful. Like, do you know what I mean? My mother actually worked in sort of crisis services and sort of mental health, and especially in women. So these spaces are not unfamiliar to me. But this Wren does feel quite different to the spaces that I've been in before. So I think having actually felt what it was like to be in here and trying to put those kind of feelings within the murals, that's what changed my ideas. Not changed my ideas, but I definitely tried to put those emotions into the murals.
Becky Orpen and Maria Bradshaw there, talking about the impact of art on the Women's Recovery Network in Melbourne. You're listening to Arts in 30 on Radio National. I'm Sky Kirkham, and every week we invite an expert from across the ABC's music networks to showcase our Song of the Week for you. This week, Ellie Parnell from Radio National's music show joins me. Ellie, welcome. What is our track this week, and why is this the one we should be listening to?
Hi, Sky. We've got a new track from Mavis Staples. She's 86 years old, so she's been singing for nearly 80 years. And this new song, I was very surprised to see it. It's a cover of a song called Beautiful Strangers by Kevin Morby. And it's a little taster of her forthcoming album, which is called Sad and Beautiful World. And in this album, she's sort of looking at the American songbook over the last 70 years. But what I think is really interesting is the amount of sort of newer songs that she's covering, really contemporary stuff, which is amazing, because she obviously keeps her finger on the pulse of what's happening in music. There's a Frank Ocean cover as well on this album. But this song was one that I loved anyway. It came out about 10 years ago, Kevin Morby's version. And it's sort of equal parts comforting and devastating. If you listen to the lyrics, it references events that were happening around that time in 2015, 2016. We've got there's terrorist attacks in Paris, and there's the Orlando nightclub shooting referenced. But her voice is just incredible. I mean, she's been singing for 80 years. She's got so much life and wisdom in it that you can hear. There's beautiful backing vocals here from Nathaniel Rateliff. There's noodly guitar from NJ Lenderman, who's one of my favourite guitarists at the moment. He's kind of indie rock royalty. So she's bringing in all these younger collaborators as well to cover these songs that kind of span this amazing period in American music.
Well, a mixture of up-and-coming legends and one of the true greats of the scene. I cannot wait to have a listen to this. Ellie, can you throw to our track of the week, please?
This is a song from Mavis Staples called Beautiful Strangers.
If you ever hear that thunder, put your eye to the sky, boy, and wonder. Maybe there's a kingdom above the weather. Oh, and whether you're gonna get on in is up to you. in a distance, like some siren. Maybe there's a singer with no ring around his little finger. Oh, love. And if I lose my voice, if I have no choice but to go quiet, won't you sing for me a melody into the night there? If I die too young and the wolf they come, fee, fi, fo, fum. If I die too young and the locusts come, then run, run, run free. If you ever hear that gunshot, you may think about what you do, but you don't got. Say a prayer, think of mother, I am a rock. Gets kicked in, here they come now. Think of others, be their cover. I am what they're not. Pray for Paris, they cannot scare us or stop the music. No, you've got a sweet voice, child. If I die too young, if the gunmen come, I'm full of love. So release me, every piece of me, up above, up above. Love my mama and my papa, love my sister, can't stand the coppers up in their choppers, oh, flying over here, 49 dead, singing, oh, my Lord, carry me home. Beautiful stranger. Ooh.
That was Beautiful Strangers by Mavis Staples, the track chosen by our music correspondent Ellie Parnell. And that's all the time we have for today. Arts in 30 is produced by Sky Kirkham. C. Benedict is our executive producer. Alice Simons, our sound engineer. And if you missed any of our interviews, you can find them all on the ABC Listen app. Just look for Arts in 30 and remember to press the heart to follow the show. And join us every Friday for the Arts in 30 Weekender, where we set aside the news and give you our tips on what to check out and what to skip from the world of the arts. I'm Sky Kirkham, and I'll catch you next time here on Arts in 30.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.